Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, throughout U.S. history, third parties have had a profound impact on policy, governance, and voter turnout. So why are we still in a two-party system? And first, some say that we have entered a new era in Supreme Court jurisprudence in the wake of the court's recent Dobbs decision, reversing nearly 50 years of law, recognize a woman's right to choose, and that this has ushered in a far more confrontational and political court. But are both political and legal considerations baked into America's judiciary by design? Our guest host, Tim Fadjin, explores these with the author of a new biography, a former First Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge, Frank Coffin.
I am Tim Fadjin. Listeners are undoubtedly aware that the United States Supreme Court is suffering from a crisis of confidence. In a recent survey conducted by Gallup, only a quarter of respondents reported confidence in the Supreme Court as an institution. Stories have emerged as well that there are even disagreements between the justices about this perception and indeed the causes for it. All of which raise questions. What do judges and courts actually do? What do we expect of judges? Who benefits from ideological polarization in the judiciary? Is there even another way? The inherently political nature of America's judicial system, both in terms of the appointment process as well as in how it makes important policy determinations, whether conservative or liberal, is one hallmark of America's judiciary. But just how such overt expressions of politics manifest in the work of the court, or whether perhaps pragmatism might instead guide decision-making, are questions worth considering. This in order to avoid, as the distinguished First Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Frank M. Coffin once described judges, as behaving like politicians in robes. This and other aspects of Judge Coffin's life are presented in an excellent new biography, A Man for All Branches, Judge Frank M. Coffin of Maine, published by Tower Publishing. With me today is the book's author, Richard Maimon, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. After earning a PhD in Political Science at Brown University, Richard taught for 40 years at the University of Southern Maine, located in Portland, Maine, specializing in courses on law and politics. With his background and interests, it was natural for Professor Maimon to turn his attention to Frank M. Coffin, not only something of a legend in Maine and New England more broadly, but a man who distinguished himself through a long and storied career in both law and politics, though, as we will learn, not necessarily in that order. Richard, welcome to the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book and about Judge Coffin.
Let's begin with a question many listeners may have. Who was Frank Coffin, and why did you choose to write about him?
Well, Frank Coffin was born in Lewiston, Maine in 1919. He attended Bates College in his hometown, then Harvard Law School. He served in the U.S. Navy in World War II, and then returned to Maine to begin a small town legal practice. He quickly established himself as one of the state's leading litigation lawyers. And in the 1950s, as a young lawyer, Frank Coffin teamed up with another young lawyer, Edmund Muskie, to revive Maine's Democratic Party, which at the time was able and seemingly content to elect only a handful of legislators from the state's industrial cities, but it was quite incapable of competing with the Republicans for statewide office. In 1954, Frank Coffin managed Ed Muskie's successful campaign for governor, and 2 years later, Coffin himself was elected to Congress. In 1961, Coffin joined the Kennedy administration as a top-level official in the field of foreign aid. In 1965, with strong support from Muskie, who was by now an important member of the U.S. Senate, Coffin was nominated by President Johnson to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, thus becoming one of only five people in the 20th century to serve in all three branches of the national government. He served for 41 years on that court, including more than a decade as its chief judge, during which he built a record that was remarkable for its non-ideological and non partisan approach. I suppose what drew my interest to Frank Coffin was that combination of political experience, indeed not just experience, but his considerable success as a politician, and then his even greater success as a judge. Throughout his career on the bench, he was able to think and act like a judge without ever forgetting what it was like to think and act as a politician, that is, as a member of the legislature or as an executive branch official. This, I think, was a key ingredient to his success as a judge. And it made me want to learn more and led me to embark on a 7-year research and writing project, which culminated a few months ago with the publication of my book.
You raised this question about Coffin's experience, political experience, having run a successful campaign for Congress, having run an unsuccessful campaign for governor, and then navigating the appointments process and serving in the executive. And this qualities were, you know, rare even over the course of the 20th century, as you note. But you also observe more broadly, not just this whole elected and executive experience, in your conclusion that judges these days tend to lack having experience in the other branches of government. What do you think has been the impact of this?
Well, there was a time when many federal judges were recruited from the other branches. Many had served in Congress or in high executive office, such as the presidential cabinet. That hasn't been true for a number of decades. It's been almost 50 years since the federal judge was appointed who had previous experience as a member of Congress. Now, the people who populate the judiciary today are certainly more diverse in terms of gender and race than they were a half century ago. But I think they are less diverse in their professional backgrounds. They tend to have attended elite law schools. Most of them have clerked for a federal judge. Some of them do have experience on Capitol Hill or in the executive branch, perhaps the Justice Department, but always as staff members, not as actual office holders who have to answer to the people through elections. And if they're interested in becoming judges, they've made career choices with that goal in mind, which means that by the time they do reach the bench, they've already been thinking like judges for a very long time. They've really never had the experience of viewing the political process from another branch, from the perspective of another branch. Their work has been concentrated and specialized. And they also tend and have tended for the last couple of decades to be much more ideological, much more identifiably conservative or liberal than judges were in the past. Because to be strongly conservative or liberal is the way to attract the attention and support that you will need to make the leap into the judiciary. What I'm suggesting is that judges today are a different breed from those who occupied the branch a half century ago when Frank Coffin first became a judge. And I think there is a consequence to that. The consequence is in the kinds of decisions that are forthcoming, which I think show less of an understanding of the work of legislators and executive officials than was typical in Coffin's day.
That's really interesting. And I think that sort of ties into another point that you made, where you've described the American judiciary as possessing these sort of two key qualities, a political and a legal. What did you mean by this?
I think Americans expect two things from judges. They expect them to be learned in the law, that is, expert at what they do, But they don't want judges to be philosopher kings. They want judges to be accountable to the political process in some fashion. This is why some 80% of all judges at the state level in the United States are elected rather than appointed. And it also is why the political the process of appointing judges to the federal courts is so intensely political, requiring presidential nomination and Senate confirmation. I think the United States is unique among the nations of the world in expecting judges to be both expert and accountable. That creates a kind of tension in the role of judge, which is unique to the judiciary, which executive branch and legislators, officials don't have to think about, don't have to worry about. And I've always been interested in trying to understand better how judges navigate the difficult and often, I would say, irreconcilable expectations that we place on them. But I think Frank Coffin probably did that as well as anybody I've ever encountered.
I think that that's a really interesting point, too, because I guess we would expect as voters and citizens that the folks in the legislature would have, in designing laws and writing laws, have some thought towards how the court would interpret them or might interpret them and make sense of them when disputes would arise. Would you agree?
Right. Well, yes, I believe that is the case. Now, one argument that has been made against what is called judicial activism is that it makes legislators, it allows legislators to get sloppy. If they think that everything they do is going to be reviewed and perhaps overruled or at least corrected by judges, then maybe they don't do their work as well as they should. That's a danger. But it's one that that Coffin was conscious of. And I might say that there have been some judges who have responded to this sort of tension that I've described, the political versus the legal, as have responded to that by stepping back and exercising extreme judicial restraint, trying not to get involved in issues that might bring them into some kind of conflict with the political branches. Felix Frankfurter was perhaps the best example in modern times of a judicial restraintist on the Supreme Court. I would not describe Frank Coffin as a judicial restraintist, for one thing, because appellate circuit court judges like Frank Coffin really have no control over their agenda. They have to decide the cases that come to them, unlike the Supreme Court, which has a considerable discretion in determining what it's going to decide and what it's going to simply let pass. Frank Coffin did not hesitate to take on the big issues. He, in fact, was the first federal judge to actually decide on the constitutionality of the Vietnam War at a time when many judges were invoking the so-called political question doctrine and refusing to even look at cases that question the constitutionality or challenge the constitutionality of the war. Coffin said, we can't avoid this. This is the kind of issue that we need to address. But then he proceeded to address it in a way which I think was typically sensitive to the roles of both the president and the U.S. Congress in prosecuting the war. So what Coffin did was not to shrink from making decisions, but to try to make decisions that were, as he put it, workable. Decisions that were clear, that gave the people they would affect very clear instructions, very clear explanations for why the court was ruling as it did. He thought that that was giving those branches the respect and the deference that they deserve as co-equal branches of the government.
Great. And I think that this speaks to some aspects of Judge Coffin's character that I want to pick up just in a moment. But I wanted to pause to say to our listeners, you are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I am Tim Fadjan, and we are discussing A Man for All Branches, Judge Frank M. Coffin of Maine, with the author, Richard Maimon. You mention in the book, and I think it's one of the most striking things about Coffin, is his strength of character. The qualities you write about, important for people generally, but perhaps not always associated with judges, humility, courteousness, having a cooperative disposition. Given your description of the American judiciary today, both in our conversation and as well as in the book, is there room for a Judge Coffin today? Someone like a Judge Coffin?
There's plenty of room for a Judge Coffin today. Judge Coffin put a very high value on collegiality. He liked being part of a collegial court, both in politics and on the bench. He enjoyed collective decision-making. He certainly believed that judges benefited from having to decide things together. And he himself was a very skillful consensus builder. He was a compromiser, which is not to say that he didn't stick to his principles. He had them and he stuck to them, but he was always willing to compromise, to find some common ground on what he considered to be peripheral matters. I think that perhaps one of the consequences of having a more ideological judiciary as we do today is that judges tend to elevate every point to a matter of principle, and thus be unwilling to make the kind of compromises that Coffin believed not only were necessary for the judiciary to function smoothly, but also he believed it led to better decision making. He was not a man who thought he had all the right answers.
And I think that insight that you so carefully uncover from reviewing his diaries and interviews with his clerks and people that knew him and worked with him, including the words of many Supreme Court justices who had worked with him on their way up or as members of the Supreme Court. But what comes through, I think, really, really clearly in your book is this importance that Coffin placed on this concept of balance, living a full life, the importance of having other outlets for one's energy. And Coffin had many, and you really write about these in a really engaging way in the book. And maybe you could tell the listeners a bit about Coffin in this respect. And I'd also want you to consider in your answer, what do you see as the benefits of having more well-rounded judges, not only for litigants, for the lawyers who appear before the courts and the parties who appear before courts, but for the general health of the judicial system?
Well, I don't say in the book that you have to be well-rounded to be a good judge. Some of the judges who are considered great had very few interests outside the law. I've always found it ironic that Oliver Wendell Holmes, whom some consider perhaps the greatest American judge, and who is famous for having said in his book on the common law, the life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. Well, Holmes himself had very little experience outside of the law. And others, Louis Brandeis, Felix Frankfurter, and others I could name. In Coffin's time, a couple of other very distinguished appeals court judges, Henry Friendly and Richard Posner, had almost monk-like existences with no interests outside the law. A few minutes ago, I put Frankfurter on that list. I should perhaps amend that because, in fact, Frankfurter was as interested in politics as he was in law. But that wasn't necessarily true of the others that I named. Well, Coffin couldn't live that way. He wanted a balanced life. He wanted time for family, for friends, for hobbies, for writing outside of his legal writing. And he wanted time to develop other dimensions of his personality. I learned in my research that there were a few occasions when his life got very badly out of balance. When he was working in the early 60s in the Kennedy administration, he was doing basically two jobs, almost 24/7. And it took a real toll on him physically and emotionally. By the time he became a judge, he was in his mid-40s, he understood himself well enough to know that while he wanted to be as good a judge as he could be, he didn't want to be only a judge. He worked very hard, but he also worked very efficiently. He was very, very organized, knew how to manage an office. He worked smart. He was able to do something that some judges, I think, find very difficult, to delegate work to his clerks. He hired smart young women and men and trusted them to do a very high level of work. Of course, in the end, it was all him. He reviewed every word they wrote. Nothing went out that didn't have his stamp of approval on it. But he simply could not have kept up with his workload without relying heavily on his clerks. He was not obsessed with perfection. If an opinion was good enough, it was good enough. He didn't want to polish it to a high sheen. So I would hesitate to say that the judiciary is not well served by having at least some judges who have nothing else in their lives but judging. But something tells me that we are all better off when the people who are making decisions about our lives actually are familiar with our lives by having had a life of their own that is not limited to decision-making in a courtroom or in chambers.
That's a great point to close on. Richard, I want to thank you for joining me today to discuss your fascinating book, A Man for All Branches, Judge Frank M. Coffin of Maine. That's available from Tower Publishing. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Tim. I've enjoyed talking to you very much.
When we come back, the role of third parties in shaping American politics historically and today. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Third parties have had a profound impact on policy, governance, and voter turnout. So why are we still in a two-party system? On this election week, we bring you from our archives this panel discussion on third parties in the United States. Third parties have been at the forefront of some of the nation's most critical social policies and institutional changes, including abolition, women's suffrage, and child labor laws. More recently, polls are revealing that many Americans are dissatisfied with the two-party system, with some 40% of Americans identifying as independent and 48% of eligible voters saying they consider it necessary to create a third party. So why are we still in a two-party system? We have with us three experts. Omar Ali is professor of African diaspora history and politics at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His books include In the Balance of Power, Independent Black Politics and Third-Party Movements in the United States, and In the Lion's Mouth, Black Populism in the New South. He's also director of independentvoting.org. Scott Schrafnagel is director of graduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Northern Illinois University. His publications include Third-Party Blues, The Truth and Consequences of Two-Party Dominance, and A Historical Dictionary of the U.S. Congress. David Gillespie also joins us. He is professor of political science at the College of Charleston and the Citadel. He has written extensively on third parties, including the recently published Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle. I would like to start with an argument that some scholars have made that great political ideas and transformations in this country have come from third parties. Professor Gillespie, I want to start with you. What would you say third parties have brought to us in terms of important ideas and changes?
Third parties, of course, do not have the resources, the human resources, to push things across the policy line. They rely upon major parties to do that. But they have been generators of some of the great ideas in our history. And you can go back to the anti-Masonic party coming out of that, besides some of the particular controversies of the time, the idea about transparency in government. There were a number of third parties that were interested in doing away with slavery, or at least in not extending slavery. One of those came in out of the cold, the Republican Party. At least six third parties before the Democrats and the Republicans came around to embracing women's suffrage, were working hard for women's suffrage. The first proposal for universal health care, and that was in the Bull Moose Progressive Party platform in 1912. And you can just go on and on and on. The kind of ideas that were incubated in third parties, or third parties worked alongside of interest groups to push the major parties in that direction.
Professor Schroffnagel.
No, I could just add to the list a little. I would agree completely. You know, there's the Wilson-Gorham tariff, co-sponsored by a member of the Populist Party back in the late 19th century, whole series of income tax reforms, farm relief, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, which provides for the direct election of senators, came from third parties. Financial regulations, there's a whole host of things.
And these came from more than one third party?
There's three third parties historically that have been probably the most productive. The anti-Masons that Dr. Gillespie's already referred to, then also the Populist Party of the late 1890s, and then also the Progressive Bull Moose Party coming in the Progressive era from 1912 forward.
Professor Ali.
One of the things that I think about when I think about third parties and change in American history is to locate third parties as part of a tactic that independent political movements, various kinds over the course of American history, have engaged in as a way of advancing their agenda, be it a single issue or multiple issues. So I do think that, yes, third parties have played this critical role, everything from the abolition of slavery to, you know, child labor laws to civil rights, et cetera. It's really, I think, a function of larger movements which produce these third parties, which then play a role in the electoral arena. So that's the way that I locate third parties, is that they're essentially a tool of independent movements to advance a certain agenda. And you see that throughout the course of American history. I mean, a basic thing to note is that it's always been the outsiders in American history that have been the engine of change. It's never been the established political parties that adopt change on their own. It's really through pressure from the outside, and third parties have played an important role in creating that kind of pressure at different points in our history.
Give us a couple of examples of these.
The greatest example, in my mind, is the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century. If you listen today to politicians, in particular Democratic politicians, they act as if it was the Democratic Party that led the civil rights movement. It's not true. It was an independent movement that was organized by people who were or in different political parties and in different associations and different bodies, whether it was the, you know, the Black Baptist Church or some minor third parties. And they came together and they pressed for certain critical changes that were needed, namely that the federal government needed to intervene and reassert these amendments that had been passed back in Reconstruction to the U.S. Constitution, and that the outcome of that was the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act. So that was an outside movement which was then picked up by, you know, Democratic legislators, in particular in the mid-1960s. To me, that's the greatest example of sort of an outside movement. But you can also look at the populace, and the populace in regards were a movement which then at a certain point, namely by around 1890 or so, formed a third party called the People's Party, and again, put the pressure on to call for certain kinds of reforms, which they didn't so much see in their generation, but it was in the generation thereafter that many of the reforms that the populists were calling for were actually put into legislation.
So what it sounds like essentially happens is that a movement develops, another party develops within it. This advocacy then is adopted by a traditional party, and maybe, I mean, I hate to use the word co-opted, but is it co-opt David Gillespie? Would you think that that's appropriate here?
Co-optation is certainly a word that is applicable. Appropriation or theft would also be terms that could be used. And of course, when third parties have their ideas stolen or appropriated, they may feel cheated by that. But very oftentimes, the most important third parties live short lives precisely for that reason. There are third parties that are sort of flashes in the pan. They may last one election round, or they may last for 10 years or something, but then they're gone. And one reason for that is that appropriation or co-optation has taken place.
That's actually a perfect leeway into the bigger question of this whole thing, which is some of these third parties emerge and become forces like the Republican Party. Others start as forces and die out, like I think the Whig Party. What determines whether or not a party is going to maintain a part of the political fabric or is going to fade out? Scott Schroffnagel?
The bottom line is that the last third party to rise up and become a major party was the Republican Party, and that took civil war. It was a complete disjuncture within the party system at the time that, you know, created this opportunity for a third party. But we haven't had that happen since. Every third party has been short-lived since that time. And there's rules and election rules and laws that are in place that have helped to create two-party dominance. Most specifically, we have a type of election in this country for the legislatures. It's called a single-member district with a plurality rule, which means whoever gets the most votes wins. And under those election conditions, right, there will only be two dominant parties. So the only chance a third party would ever have under the current election format is to try to replace one of the major parties, but then we'd be back to a two-party system. Back to the earlier point about some of the ideas that third parties have had, I just would like to add that when I answered your question, I was thinking about very direct and obvious sort of causal sort of specific piece of legislation. If you add just the ideas, now the influence of third parties has been even greater.
Omar Ali?
I agree completely. I think that, you know, sort of independent and third parties have played a major role in shaping the vision of what America is at different points. I don't think that there is a single reason, because at different moments there are different factors at play, but certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, to go back to what you were saying about the election laws being discriminatory and the, you know, the rules and the election, the system, just the issue of ballot access. So, for instance, if you want to run as a third-party candidate and get on the ballot in all 50 states, it requires something like 20 times the number of signatures than if you're a Democrat or Republican. And the reason why is because the legislators, the Democrats and Republicans in office, write the election laws to basically keep themselves in power. They do that in other ways. For instance, the ways that, you know, districts are formed, you know, every 10 years, the redistricting is done on partisan lines. It's not done in some sort of logical way, again, to favor one or the other major party. You have the issue of primaries or closed primaries, which basically lock out independents in something like half of the states right now. So there are a number of ways in which the two major parties create rules and regulations to keep themselves in power. So that's a problem, and most people aren't aware of that unbelievable kind of discrimination that's going on. So we have basically anybody who's not in a third party, essentially they have to deal with a set of laws that make them effectively a second-class citizen, not to over sort of make the connection to the kind of suffering and trauma and victimization of black people under Jim Crow. But in the law, there really is a second-class status for independents and third-party candidates. And the reason why you don't hear about most of them is because it takes enormous resources for them to be in any way competitive. So we heard about Ross Perot in 1992, but he put in $70 million of his own money. But the Democratic and Republican parties start off their national campaigns with $50 million taxpayer money each. So the regular person or even a smaller third party has no way of competing in a meaningful way. So it's discriminatory, it's undemocratic, and that's the system that we have.
This is David Gillespie. I think it would be very important to point out that what we really have in contemporary America is not so much a free-flowing two-party system. That existed in the 19th century. What we have now is a duopoly, and I mean by that an imposed two-party system in which the ideal for the architects of that system, and I don't mean that in any conspiratorial sort of way, but just in the natural order of power holders using power for themselves, the ideal is to eliminate all third parties entirely. In the 19th century, before the secret ballot came in the 1880s, the parties did their own ticket making. We still talk about the Democratic ticket or the Green ticket or something like that, but we've forgotten what that meant. It meant in the 19th century that third parties printed their own ballots and distributed them when people went to vote, and people voted publicly. Obviously, it was a great step forward from the standpoint of secrecy when we went to secret ballot, but that put the ballot access in the hands of the states, and by 1930, the states were hell-bent in using that to exclude parties other than the Democrats and Republicans. I think what Scott was talking about, the single-member district, is probably the principal reason why we have two parties. And I can't say that that institution was instituted for the purpose of discrimination, because single-member district is older than what most democracies use today, which is the PR system, and which is conducive to a multi-party system.
That's proportional representation for our listeners that don't know PR, proportional representation.
That's right. But we have added to that these deliberate discriminatory things that Omar was talking about, including ballot access and debate discrimination and all of these kinds of things. And the intent is to close the door on it. Britain today has a real two-party system. It uses single-member district for its national elections, but the access to the ballot is equal for every person seeking access to the ballot, and it is a low threshold. It involves collecting a few signatures on a petition and paying a very small filing fee. That's not the way we conduct business.
Now, speaking of closed primaries, single district, that sort of a thing, now California's experimenting with open primaries so that top two go. There are a lot of complaints about what that's actually going to do. Will it open the door for third-party candidates?
This is David Gillespie. Top two is yet another thing that probably was not intended to discriminate against third parties, but has that effect, because what it does is to open the primary so broadly that, you know, it basically takes the party role out, and at the general election, it's very unlikely that any third-party candidate is going to appear. They will disappear in that top two primary system. So I don't like that system from the standpoint of yet another barrier that has been erected that discriminates.
Scott Strafnagel?
There's really five different election arrangements, if you will, that influence third parties. Ballot access laws is one. The nature of primaries, whether they're closed and open. Another that we haven't mentioned yet is the fusion candidate. A candidate can run under multiple party labels. But then going back to what I talked about, single-member districts and plurality rule. Now, my work has shown that of those five issues, it's the single-member district plurality rule that is the real culprit. And actually, I've been able to trace, I don't know if I'd call it a conspiracy, but some of there's mention in the congressional record from the 1840s when Democrats and Whigs were the two major parties and some of these single-member district plurality rule laws were written. They were multi-member districts were the norm when the Congress was first formed. And there is evidence that they were doing it on purpose to promote a two-party system, not because they necessarily were trying to kill third parties at that time, but they thought it was going to be more effective. And, you know, and a lot of times when people debate this, party system, whether a two-party system or a multi-party system is best. That debate centers on two-party dominance, which we have today, versus multi-party systems. They fail to realize that there are other party options, particularly like a two-and-a-half-party system, which we experienced in the progressive era and to a certain extent in the populist era. But ballot access laws and closed primaries and fusion candidates, I have found that they are statistically linked to lower third-party voting, but not enough to make a difference, not enough for them to win. If we're going to have effective third parties, we'll have to dismantle single-member district plurality rule. Short of that, it's not going to happen.
Isn't that, particularly with congressional races and senatorial races, that embedded in the Constitution?
Not at all. The only thing the Constitution says about elections is that states should do their own thing. And so what I would imagine, you know, if reform were to ever come, it would come in the states that allow for initiatives, just like we have states now that have legalized gambling or gay marriages. Those states where you allow the people to have some say, they would be the ones to first experiment. And the irony is that multi-member districts are not completely foreign to the American system, right? Illinois had multi-member districts up till 1980 for state legislators. That's the state I live in, but many states still have multi-member districts. All of our city councils and county commissions are often multi-member. So it's not a foreign concept, and majority rule is not a foreign concept either. And so we're talking about moving from plurality rule to majority rule, single-member district to multi-member district. That's the key. That's what would make the difference. That's what would allow third-party success. I would guess the only way it's going to ever happen, it would have to happen sort of state by state with experimentation.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the role of third parties in American politics. Well, it seems California is starting to experiment, at least on the city level, with the single transferable voting. I don't want to get into the technicalities of that, but it is one way of ranking candidates and therefore being able to vote for more than one candidate in rank order, which allows some to vary their preferences. But California actually links us into another issue, which is the rise of people who are independent. I understand California's decline to state a particular party. Its ballot designation is decline to state a party, is among the fastest growing parties. Do we see this trend anywhere else? Omar Ali, I know you particularly study African Americans. What can you tell us about independent voters who don't register with parties?
Independent voters who don't register with parties are the fastest growing grouping of people in America in terms of the election system. It's sort of astonishing how fast the growth is. Here in North Carolina, 2 out of 3 new registered voters are registering as unaffiliated, which is what we have as the category that's not Democratic or Republican or Libertarian. It is unaffiliated. So it's the fastest growing. It's just past the 25-26% mark. And if you look at that in relationship to also what it is that the, you know, Gallup and Pew and other national polls are indicating, somewhere between 40-42% of Americans as a whole are now self-identifying as independent. Now, many political scientists will say, well, the true independents are actually much smaller because they either lean for, you know, towards the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. But I don't think that that's fair. Because if people are simply presented with 2 viable options, that is a candidate that will win, if they're asked a follow-up question, you know, which way do you lean, then I think, of course, people are going to tend to go one way or the other because they want to have some impact on the outcome of the general election. But this phenomenon, the rise of the independent voter, is just absolutely fascinating. And the thing that you see is that people aren't registering en masse into third parties. They're saying they don't want to register into any political party. They don't want to be part of any particular grouping of people necessarily. So what's interesting is that a lot of these people are forming essentially the margin of victories, as we saw in 2008 with President Obama. And to go back to the question of African Americans, we had basically a black and independent alliance providing his margin of victory, something like 96-97% African-American voters going for the president in the general election. And he won about 8-point margin of independence against Senator McCain. And it was independents and also African Americans that carried him in the primaries. So independents are playing this very important role, not only in North Carolina, but in California and across the country, really. But I do want to respond to something that David said about the top two, which is I take a slightly different stance than him. I think that top two for me in California is actually a positive reform. It's a positive reform because it allows independent voters who are more often than not barred from party primaries to effectively fully participate in the electoral process. And it also breaks the hold of the political parties on the candidate selection process. So for third-party advocates, it's not great. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of independents, that is those outside of the two major parties who don't affiliate with a third party, then it's a great thing because it starts to challenge the sort of the control that the two major parties have on the selection process of their candidates. So independents are on the rise, and African Americans are also diversifying. Right now, the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies is reporting about close to 30% of African Americans self-identifying as independent. So we're seeing this across the sort of the age, race, gender, and ideological spectrum of America.
David Gillespie, let's bring you back in. Let's address some of the more modern third parties as well. We saw Ralph Nader run a couple of times. We have one senator who's independent, Bernie Sanders. We talked about Ross Perot, and we also have Mayor Bloomberg.
Well, you would like to think that that indicates some opening. So there are always these things on the periphery, but still the cards are very stacked. And I would really come to how people look at this. I think Omar is exactly right. When you look at the Gallup polls over the last 10 or 15 years, you see that people affirm that the two major parties are serving us so poorly that we need to have at least one major alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. And the rate of affirmation ranges from something like 40% in some years up to about 53%. The Gallup poll says that a plurality now, not a majority, but a plurality still affirm that we need a third party. And what you oftentimes hear people say, political scientists call it voting strategically or voting tactically. What ordinary citizens call it is voting for the lesser of two evils. And, you know, that is sort of part of the popular culture. Don't throw your vote away. Don't vote with your heart. Vote with your head. Vote for the major party candidate that you can live with if you can't live with both of the major party candidates. So this whole issue of spoiling is a real problem for third parties. There are some institutional proposed reforms in the instant runoff voting, for example, which would have, I think you mentioned that in one of your questions, but instant runoff voting would allow a person to cast a first choice vote for his heart and then cast a second choice vote for his head or her head if you wanted to, and you don't have the sense of throwing your vote away. There is also the National Popular Vote Compact movement to try to reform the electoral college system, which also discriminates against third parties without going through the constitutional amendment process, which would be impossible to change. So there are some interesting movements out there, but I think still that problem is the idea that you can't throw your vote away. If you vote for a third party candidate, you're throwing it away and you're electing the major party candidate that you less would like to see.
I'm certain that the mass media compound that with the way that they cover elections. Scott Schraffnagel.
Well, you know, in terms of successful third-party candidates in the modern era, we get them. But more often than not, I mean, there's only a couple of ways it happens. One is they've got a boatload of their own money that they're willing to spend. They've got name recognition through sports or celebrity of some sort, or they're a former Democrat or Republican. But minus those qualities, minus celebrity or your own money or formerly successful Democrat or Republican, now there's just almost no third-party success or independent candidate success. And the reason is very clear. It's what Dr. Gillespie's talking about. People don't want to waste their votes. Under single-member district plurality rule, if you were to plot people's preferences over on a scatter plot, you would find that it would take on a bell shape. And at the top of that bell is somebody called the median voter. And there's only two sides to that median voter, which means there's only room for two political parties. It doesn't do any good for parties to form on the left or the right because they're not going to win. Any district that you sit down in, its constituents, their preferences are going to take on a bell shape. It's a statistical law. So there's a mathematical reason, but there's also the psychological reason that Dr. Gillespie refers to, and that is that people don't want to waste their vote. Why am I going to vote for my heart and who I really want if I know they don't have any chance of winning? And so under the current election laws, third parties can't win.
One of you wrote about Mayor Bloomberg and his fusion campaign. Of course, he has his own money and he had name ID also. But without the fusion, Republican and independent, could he have won?
That was me, Omar. I talk about it in my first book, In the Balance of Power. That was a fascinating sort of campaign because in New York City, most people are Democrats. And what happened was that he was personally fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And he had never run for office, and he decides that he's going to take a shot at it. And so he sees that the Democrats, there were like five people gunning for the nomination, and he looked at the Republicans, and there was one other person. So he said, okay, well, I can get my name on that ballot if I can beat out the other Republican. And then he went and asked the Independence Party of New York if they would support him, getting him on the ballot, and they would run, you know, a fusion campaign, which is allowed in very few places, in New York being one of them. And that margin, which he won, was attributed in good part to the Independence Party of New York, and not just the number of votes that he won on the Independence Party line, but in terms of the organizing that the Independence Party was engaged in communities of color. One of the founders of that party was actually the first woman and the first African-American to get on the ballot in all 50 states in the United States. This was 20 years before Barack Obama. And her name is Dr. Lenora Fulani. And Fulani did that in 1988 by winning 11 election state suits and gathering about 1.5 million signatures. The entire campaign was geared around trying to simply break that barrier. And 4 years later, when Ross Perot decided that he was going to run, who did he go to but none other than Dr. Fulani's attorneys to get help on how to actually get on the ballot because they're so difficult, in some places virtually impossible. So New York had this fascinating thing which brought together the Independence Party, which was multiracial and working in different communities of color and in poor and working class communities, which allowed Bloomberg to have some sort of authority in those communities. And many people went out and voted for him because of that connection. So independence in New York City played a critical role. And I don't think by himself running as a Republican, there are many people in America that are just sort of pragmatic and they register whatever party is most helpful that they see at that time. And he is reflecting in some ways a larger sentiment in America, which is moving away from registering and being part of any political party.
What is the role that these minor parties are going to be able to play? Will they be able to play the kind of historic roles that we've seen throughout American history in bringing these important issues forward?
They can, clearly. I mean, the best example of that probably is Ross Perot. In 1992. I mean, he came up with the idea of a balanced budget, you know, that, I mean, people had talked about it, but it brought it to the American public's attention, you know, through 30-minute infomercials with his charts, and people saw that we were, you know, spending more than we were bringing in. And you know, I would argue whoever got elected in 92 was going to have to address the budget deficit, which Bill Clinton and then the subsequent Republican Congress do successfully. And so the point is that third parties can still be that engine for new ideas, but you know, at some point, you know, I think a third party might like to win something. You know, right now the deck's so stacked against them, the best they can do is play a spoiler role And more often than not, that's not in the best interest of the third-party advocates, right? So if that third-party presidential candidate is coming from the left or the right, if they spoil it for the Democrat or the Republican, respectively, they're that much worse off.
It certainly cost Ralph Nader a great deal of empathy, sympathy, relationships when he ran and people called him a spoiler.
Ralph Nader has a very good response to that, and it is that a major party candidate is much more likely to rob votes from a minor party candidate because of that very issue of spoiling. And I remember in 2000, so many Democratic signals, don't throw your vote away on Ralph Nader. And those people who voted for Ralph Nader voted for Ralph Nader. And it was obscene, in my opinion, for the Democrats in that case, or the Republicans in the case of Ross Perot, to say you robbed us of the election. Because, you know, people who take that step of stepping outside the major parties and voting for an independent or third party candidate intend to do that. And I think they go into that fully aware that probably their candidate is not going to win, but it's important to vote principle sometimes.
On that note, I recall an article in the American Political Science Association's journal about the Ralph Nader election, specifically in Florida. And the finding was that the people who voted for him actually were not going to vote had he not been in the election.
Absolutely. And when you focus on Florida, probably the official count would have been on Al Gore's side had it not been for the thousands of votes that went to Ralph Nader. But those people who voted for Ralph Nader intended to vote for Ralph Nader. It was not a mistake on their part. And many of them, as you say, and studies have shown this, would not have voted had it not been for Nader's candidacy. Between the two major parties, they agree on nothing but pulling the ladder up against third parties. And they don't agree on anything by way of policy. And we're totally paralyzed because what the Democrats gain, the Republicans lose, and vice versa, you know. So I think our system is paralyzed by our duopoly now.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Omar Ali is professor of African diaspora history and politics at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His books include In the Balance of Power, Independent Black Politics and Third-Party Movements in the United States, and In the Lion's Mouth, Black Populism in the New South. He's also director of independentvoting.org. Scott Schraffnagel is director of graduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Northern Illinois University. His publications include Third Party Blues, The Truth and Consequences of Two-Party Dominance, and A Historical Dictionary of the U.S. Congress. David Gillespie also joins us. He is professor of political science at the College of Charleston and the Citadel. He has written extensively on third parties, including the recently published Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.